Eternal
Welcome to episode 2 of the series 2, season 2, episode 2. Series is UK, isn't it, Mark? And the seasons is American.
Yeah, we're becoming more Americanized as we progress. So everything I watch is now, it's seasons of The Walking Dead, seasons of Game of Thrones, which I'm still waiting for the next one.
Yeah, I listened to... what was it now? It might have been a Stuff You Should Know podcast. And it was about Monty Python. It was like, what's the deal with Monty Python or something it was called. If you don't listen to Stuff You Should Know, it's one of my favourite podcasts. It's really good, and there's millions of them. It's all about Monty Python, and they were talking about, I didn't know in England they have series, not seasons. And they still were calling it season one and stuff. But if you don't know the history of Monty Python, it's pretty interesting, actually. How it all came about, and in the paedophile era of the BBC. But yeah, I won't spoil it for you. But yeah, have a listen. Yeah. And if you don't listen to Stuff You Should Know, then you really should do. And there's a sister one called Stuff You They Don't Want You to Know, which is all conspiracy theory stuff. It's all factual. None of it hearsay. But check out those two podcasts. We don't normally do it. Worth a look in our extra content. But if you people listening to this are probably hungry for audio comment. Content. Content,
content,
yeah,
so, comments. But if you also like content and comments, and this comes from listening to Joe Rogan, go on some of the Flat Earth Facebook groups. Just troll them. It's brilliant. They absolutely believe the Earth is flat, and it is fun. They are just... They say you should never argue with an idiot, but...
One of my friends made a funny one of my good friends, not Facebook friends, but somebody I actually know from Blackpool. He made a comment the other day, put a Facebook post saying, "What the fuck?" And he posted his picture of the Flat Earth Society, 8 friends like this group. It was like, get the fuck off my Facebook now. And he's a normal guy. He hasn't got 5,000 fishing friends. You know, he's got a few hundred people that he actually knows on his page.
8 of them think the Earth is flat.
Maybe they're just member to be a troll of the group. I don't know. But
it is funny.
Yes, it is funny. So, season 2, episode 2 of the Carpcast Extra. We have some fantastic guests for you. We've got Chili, Adam Penning, Ian McMillan.
Ian Russell, Steve Briggsy,
and Lee Jackson.
Yep.
As we did last episode, what we're asking them this time, Mark?
This time we're going to have maybe a touch of a negative, but everyone has disasters and everyone has fish that get away. It's something everyone can relate to. So, and we've got some brilliant stories.
Yes, we have. We've got some fantastic ones. I don't know. It's always interesting to hear. I know it's negative, but they can be funny sometimes, the stories as well. Yeah. But we'll relate to that heart wrenching one of the one that got away. You know that it's every fisherman's favourite story, isn't it? The big one that escaped. On series 1, I told a story about a fish I lost at Fendrayton that I truly believe was the stripy common fish that never got caught, as far as I know. Lifetime, I'd definitely seen it. My friend seen it. Had two people I know saw it and saw it with me. by far the biggest fish I've ever seen. And I never saw this fish when I lost it, but we were picking off. Dave and I were, we sent a group of half a dozen fish that seemed to live in this area for a couple of weeks, and we picked off a few bites between us, and one of the ones that I lost was ridiculous, and it opened a size 6 quarter wide gape the first batch. Pretty much on the take, it's powered off, but we caught most of the other fish in that group that we saw, bar one. There was another 40 mirror that had been on the missing list for years. I mean, it could have been anyone in that group, to be honest, but it hurt not knowing. But I already told that story. Have you got a new story, Mark?
It's a new old story. I don't remember the last time I told one. I'm pretty certain I told one, because my memory is not what it used to be now I'm 40, but yeah, it was about the Mothering on Pit 2, where it just smashed me up in the back bay. The other one was a December night in the Sunken Island, same lake. And you know what, you have to get caught in the Sunken Island, don't you?
Yeah,
and the very reason I was
Maximus.
Yeah, the reason I was fishing that swim and liked it and tried to beat you down there every bloody week. Now, I got an absolute storm intake. I was fishing a bit further out than normal, down in around between 18 and 20 foot over the back of the old island, and you know, it was just, it felt heavy. You know, when you've got heavy fish on, it goes on a run, it comes to a stop, and it just seems to like hold there forever before it turns, and you just think, wow, that's big. It's like turning like a tanker. This was like that, and it never once did I feel in control. But after a while, the fish was like running, and I could feel my line grating on something. I'd pull it back so far, and it'd lock up. So my line's got round a snag, which was plenty in there. And I don't know, after several, you know, twos and fros and putting the rod back in the rest and letting the line go slack and having a brew and shaking, then pulling again, the line went. That one really did hurt, because we know the twin had been out the previous February. It was, didn't mind a winter capture. That was its area. It was a big, big fish I lost.
Well, the mother never got caught from that area, like, ever. Hardly even got seen there, did it? Seemed to leave that corner alone. The twin was 80% the twin captures were from that corner, weren't they?
Yeah, between that and the next peg, the Terminator, which is fishing, you know, roughly similar areas, but I caught her in the end, so I got revenge on that one. But that, with that capture then, that meant I'd lost the two big ones in the same season.
And, yeah, there's a few I wish I had caught. One of them was more recently. It was last winter. I was on a feature for Carp TV. I was fishing.
I remember this one.
Yeah, I was fishing on Northampton Place. What's it called? Bluebell. And was fishing really slow. Weather had been really mild, and then it went super cold, like clear. But the fish was showing pretty well in front of me, and I had put one rod out on a zig. You could use four rods, I think, that time. Yeah, in fact, can you use four rods all year round? I'm not sure, but I certainly could then anyway. And I've got one rod out on a zig. It was our second night, and I had a bite about 1 o'clock in the morning. The bobbin just hit the deck. Typical sort of zig bite, a drop back, as obviously the fish picks the lead up and lifts it off the bottom because it's high up in the water. And I had an epic battle. Felt like a really heavy fish. And it kited a long way down to the left, like so much so I thought it'd gone through all Joe Morgan's rods. He was fishing to the left, and I didn't hear a beep off his alarms. It's moody with zigs, isn't it, when you're going through, you know, when you're dragging across other rods or whatever, it's very easy for them to pick anything up that's in the way.
Oh, definitely.
On a super long hook link, but I ended up getting it back up in front of me. I'd kind of lost all the danger, because the only snags in the entire lake were across Joe's peg to the left in the corner. It was like a snag bush, and the fish seemed to head for that, and I was thinking, oh no, it's literally the only snag in the lake and it's gone for it. And anyway, I ended up getting it back in front of me and pulled it right in front, and it just came off. It didn't just come off, it snapped about an inch below the knot. Obviously using light line for zigs, probably If it was a little too light, it's probably like 10-12 pound Fox Zigline. And ended up putting the rod back out again. Just as I got in bed, it went again. And I had another fish that bumped off almost instantly. Same thing happened. Bobbin hit the deck, leant into a fish, had it on for about 5 seconds, and it bumped off. Which could have been equally as big or bigger than the other fish. But I looked at the catch reports for the previous November, and I think it did like five fish and two of them 50s, and they're all big ones. Just seems to do big fish that time of year. Not many, but they're all big ones. And I don't know, I just had the feeling it was a really good fish. And I'd definitely have that one back. And being on a feature as well, you know, it doesn't matter how big it was, it would have been really worthwhile.
Yeah, you do feel under a bit of pressure on features to do something, don't you, to prove that you know what you're on about.
I'm always envious of people on features that have those mega sessions, you know, they catch a 40 yeah. or a load of fish. I'm like, how do you do it? I just don't have any lakes that I know well enough to be able to just turn up and do a feature on. And, and most features that you do, they want to do them in the south because that's where everyone's based. And, you know, by the time you've driven south, you're quite often fishing a lake that you don't know. It's not like, you know, you live around the M25 and you know all the lakes around there in the back of your hand, and you can look, you know, what the condition's doing today, right? Well, the fish will be in that corner on that lake. You know, it's like having multiple options to choose from. The weather's blowing westerly, right? That lake's no good, but I know a spot where they'll have fish on this particular lake. There's something about having lots of info about multiple different lakes if you're lucky enough to live in an area where there are where there is plenty of choice. Yeah. I've always just focused on one lake, so, and usually low stock, which doesn't lend itself to doing features.
No, you know, I did one earlier this year. I'd, Tom from Crafty Carper came out to see us, and he came to see us on Icon, which I chose because I know it well. I looked at the weather, I'm thinking, yeah, quick walk round, and I know, you know, narrowed it down to several areas before I'd even got there, because you know the lake that well. And I get us there the day before, and I've got a fish before the rest of the rods are even out.
Wow.
Got a long story short, I caught four in the morning, all on single hook baits. You know, Tom's coming to me the following day. I'm thinking, I'm on for a shed full here. And I got nothing else and nothing while Tom was there.
Oh, dear.
But I do a good self-take anyway, a good selfie.
Shall we? Who should we hear from? I reckon, let's hear Briggs's one that got away.
Yep.
I think losing fish always hurts. You know, I never, but it, I mean, there's sometimes when you're having a good session and you lose fish and it doesn't matter that much. It's just another fish. I suppose there is times when you lose a fish and you've worked so hard for it and it means a lot. And, you know, I can remember losing fish as far back as like the 70s, the 1970s. And they still sort of hurt, you know. When I go through it in my mind, it's still painful. I suppose, yeah. I mean, I'll just tell that story from the one I remember from the 70s because it's still painful to me. And I was still at school then, and you know, I didn't catch many carp in those days. It was, and I was fishing Brooklands. You know, I was born and brought up in the Darent Valley, and I was, you know, obviously naive then, you know, I was only just starting to catch a few carp and they were very few and far between. And I was also competing against some of the best carp anglers in the country who were fishing down that way at the time. So, you know, every carp was sort of hard earned and a bit special. And it was in the winter and I was fishing, I remember I used to cast across this other bank, you know, quite a, an out-of-bounds bank, and the carp always used to be along there, and I'd hook this carp one morning, played it all the way across, and it just got caught in a little trailing branch or willow next to me, and it was just out of reach of the net. And this guy was standing there talking to me. I didn't know who he was. There was a couple of us standing there, and he had waders on. And I said, you know, just wade out, you net it easy. And I could see, you know, this fish was just caught on the branch. It was on the surface. And he said, no, I've got a hole in my waders. I don't want to get wet. And I said, you know, just get it. I was desperate to get this fish. And he said, no, I can't, you know. And the fish actually snapped the hook and it was gone, and I was so gutted because, I mean, carp were few and far between anyway, but winter carp, it was probably one of only sort of two or three that I'd hooked all that winter. And to be that close, you know, it was, well, like I say, you know, it was the mid-70s I'm talking about here, and I still remember it today. It still annoys me, you know. I want to go back, and I should have just jumped in myself and netted it. I suppose, I mean, there's loads of other fish that I've lost down the years that were good ones. You know, I mean, well, even going back to Lemire, the first carp I hooked on there, I lost. And that was an annoying one because I'd worked so hard for it. And people talked about a big common, you know, in Lemire. They all knew about the Black Mirror, and there was all these sort of rumours about a big common. And sure enough, you know, I saw that big common three or four times. And when I saw it, the Black Mirror was there, this big common was there, and two or three others. And it was in solid weed, so all I thought, well, I'm going to try and bait up every little area I could find, which I found seven little clear spots, only like a foot wide or something like that. Put some bait on them, came back the next day, six of them were untouched, and one of them, the bait was all gone. So, you know, that evening, I dropped a little rig. It was right in the margin. I could lower the rig and position it exactly how I wanted to on this little clear spot. And at midnight, it absolutely hammered off. And it frightened the life out of me, to be honest. It absolutely scared me. It was that bad. I actually fell off my bed. I was underneath this bramble bush, and I rolled down the bank. And I'm feeling around me for the rod. You know, it's pitch black. I was thinking, where's the rod? And I was actually laying on it. I fell down the bank on the rod, and I was actually laying on top of the rod. And I picked the rod up, wound like fury, and just heard the clonk as the leg clip hit the tip ring. It, you know, it was gone. The hook length had gone on the knot, and, oh, you know, I was gutted, absolutely gutted. Don't know what fish it was. Could have been any of them, but absolutely gutted I was. Yeah, I can't think of anything that sort of hurt more than that one, really.
Yeah, I can imagine. You know, I fish some hard lakes myself, and especially that first bite that you work so hard for, it pains.
It does, doesn't it? I mean, there's some, like I say, where you just lose them and you move on, and there's others, you know, that just stay with you. That pain never sort of seems to go away.
Yeah.
Just you want to turn the clock back, don't you, and do it different.
Yeah, I had one back on, pit two at Elstow. I was chasing the mother and twin around, and I hooked this fish. It's in the back bay, and now fishing locked up to sight some reeds, and it just flat rodded me. I'm a big chap. It pulled me off balance, so I had no choice just to literally let it go into the reeds and then deal with it once it had stopped. So I did. I went for a swim.
Yeah.
Pulled my hook out of a reed stem, and that was that. But
oh no!
Later on that day, it's 30 degrees. It is roasting hot. You know, this was probably about 5:30 in the morning when I hooked the fish. But you know, you can see there's little bow waves and dimples out in the middle. All the fish are out there, apart from one. The mother, she's sat in the back of this bay in these reeds, and she's not on the top. She's like 3 or 4 foot down, sulking.
No.
Yeah. Oh. We just kind of like made eye contact while she's there, and she just, you know, looked at me with disdain and just kind of like didn't even spook, just kind of like sunk a bit more and melted off.
Oh, God. Oh, I don't know what's worse. You know, it's just, it happens to everyone, doesn't it?
Oh, it does. It's part of the game. We can't win them all, but I can still, in my mind, I can just still picture her just looking at it. She might, I don't know if I say made eye contact, she might not, but it just looked like her eye just tilted for a second just up at me.
That same sort of, same area of the lake on the Mere, you know, I used to get up a little tree and watch them, and there was one time where there was three or four commons, and one sort of peeled off the group, came over, literally sort of about 8 or 10 foot below me, and actually tilted on its side, and I could see its eye looking straight at me. You know, it definitely came over to have a look at me. and sort of tilted on its side and looked straight up at me and then sort of just tilted back down and swam back. But I thought, oh, well, I've been sussed. Do you know what I mean? It just looked me straight in the eye. It was quite weird, yeah. Actually, quite unnerving.
Yeah. Do you think it went back into the group of fish and said, you know, watch out, lads, Briggs is here?
yeah, keep your eye on him, he's watching us.
Yeah.
Like Briggsy says, it always hurts, doesn't it? Whatever it is.
Yeah, and I know there's some good stories to come, and it's, we can all share that pain.
So, yes.
Now, nowadays, I try and convince myself everything I lose is just a big tench.
Big bream, probably. I know, you always land the bream, don't you?
Yeah, that's my forte.
So I've seen a lot of Jacko recently. I spoke to him for these questions, and I also saw him last night before last at the musical do. Watched Jacko play bass when we were doing our gig, and we will be doing another gig. If you didn't get a chance to go to that one, there's a very good chance we're going to be playing at the Northern Angling Show. So we look forward to that. But right now, let's hear what Jacko said about his one that got away.
One which was quite a long one ago, you know, long before I fished places like Conybrook and like the Colne Valley and places like that. And there was a lake over in Essex. It's still there, as I think. I don't know if it's still fished by anyone. A lake called the Tunnel, or Kennington, it was named. It's a Tunnel Angling Club. And the lake was called Kennington's. And there's, if you're looking, Rob Malian's book, Tiger Bay, I think it is, there's a picture of a fish that I think the chapter is entitled Tunnel of Love. And there's Phil Harper holding this really nice looking mirror. And, well, I fished that lake for two seasons, really. I mean, I think it's just really doing afternoon sessions after work. I don't think there was very many fish in it. There was, you know, I only ever saw three different carp, including the big one. And when I say big, it's big for the time. It was around about 38 pounds, something like that. Lovely looking mirror. And I had the opportunity to stalk it one day on a bit of flake and actually hooked it. And, you know, and unfortunately lost it. And that really, really sort of affected me, you know. I just didn't know if I was ever going to get a chance. And then shortly after that, I was playing in, like, the following season. I was baiting the lake, all was pro season, everything. And then, for some reason, the angling club lost the rights to the lake right just before the start of the season. And I was actually devastated, you know. I mean, to be perfectly honest, I felt like packing up carp fishing because I'd done all this work baiting the place and everything, and suddenly couldn't fish there. But luckily, that's when I met a guy called Alan Partridge, and he introduced me to Arrow. About a week before the season started, I managed to join the club, give him some bullshit story about fish for bream or something. And there's no need to do that at the time. And paid me £8 membership. Extortion at £2 joining fee, and another, you know, another great achievement really was on the first day of the season I caught a 40 pounder, you know, and that was 1983, and that just blew us all away, you know.
It was a story of one that got away that led on to bigger and better things.
That's right, yeah. That payback time it was on June the 16th, yeah. So. It turned out all good in the end.
Yeah, it's interesting. We think about the one that got away as one that, you know, we actually hooked it and lost it for whatever reason. But quite often it can be because the fish died. You know, you imagine spending a significant period of time fishing for carp and it dies. And then also maybe it got swiped or something, you know, fishing for a fish that either wasn't there because you were given bad info or was stolen.
Yeah, that's painful. So, like, somebody just stealing your dreams, or... Right, do you remember back in Elstow 2 days when they blocked the back bay off? We were all fishing for the twin in the main lake and it was trapped in a half-acre back bay.
Yeah, so what happened there, there was a little bay that had a small gap to get through, And what we didn't know at the time, but when the twin was caught, as it was that February, just before they blocked the bay off, the twin used to go sulking in the back bay, as maybe some other fish did when they'd been hooked. The twin was in this tiny little bit at the back in February, and it was blocked up with a digger. They filled the gap in and made like a bund. So that was then named Pit 4 or something, was it? Did they call it Pit 3?
Yeah, they did, as a joking name, as a back bay or Pit 4 or anything. But it took, well, we know there was one or two carp in here. A few people have speculated it was one called Speckles. But it was your friend Jay. He just stuck a rod in there while he was fishing down that side of the lake, as people did occasionally, and off it rattled and had a 43-pound, much sought-after twin on the end.
Yeah, and there were, you know, people, very good anglers, claiming to have been, you know, had the twin on their spots and stuff in the main lake in Pit 2, which was clearly not true, because the twin was safe and sound in a little bay at the back.
Yeah, unless the twin did its bestest Free Willy impression and jumped over the pathway that had been created.
Yeah, that was a funny one there. Yeah, that was Jay's PB. I know Jay's beaten his PB twice this year on Dinton White Swan. I know he's quite pleased to actually not have a fish caught out of that little bay as his PB. It's took him over 10 years to beat it. But ironically, his new PB is the twin Dinton.
From Dinton.
Yeah, his two twins. Yeah.
What goes around. But I remember back then one or two people, you know, slating Jay, saying it shouldn't count because he caught it from there. But let's be honest, it damn right it does count. And if we knew that it was definitely the twin in there, there would be bivvies all the way around that little back bay.
Yeah,
we'd
all fish for it if we knew it was definitely in there, for sure. It's I feel the same as Jay. I'd have counted it, but you know, I'd have been glad to sort of not have it as my PB, you know, because his rod had been in there an hour when he caught it. That shows the kind of merit of it. It was just starving in the back bay, not getting fed in the main lake, and you know, wanted to get caught. So
it can't have been starving that much. It was a top weight.
Yeah, well, maybe it had no competition for food apart from that 3-pound perch that we all caught. Was it a perch?
It was a rudd. Great big mug rudd.
That's right, the mug rudd.
Yeah. Mug rudd.
Yeah, it was 2-pound 12-ounce, a big rudd, and you could like literally freeline or ledger like half a boilie, just side hooked on like a smallish hook, and it'd get caught 3-4 times in a day easily.
Yeah, if you got bored, I'm going to catch the rudd.
Yeah, it was the same one because it had a mark on its side. Yeah, we all caught it. I caught it like two consecutive casts, I think. Yeah, off a similar sort of area. It just kept getting itself caught. That probably is my PB rudd. But Elstow had some big rudd in at one time, didn't it?
Oh, it had some clonking great rudd. I believe if you watch some of the old, John Wilson, even Matt Hayes videos, you know, the old reruns that are on Discovery Channel, you know, some of them are done on Elstow.
Yeah.
You know, back in the day, you know, from, you know, 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah. What, have you ever fished for a carp that's died while you've been fishing it for it?
Not that I recall. You know, not a big fish. There's not a particular target fish that's paddle. Cluster in the wool crack, of course.
Yeah, yeah. Paddle was one that was a bit disappointed. I'd invested a couple of years in that lake when it died. What else? The pingewood fish, the big one.
Oh, the jockey.
The jockey, yeah, that had gone 50. I just managed to get a night season permit on there, which were not easy to come by. I just got one, never actually went down to the lake, and it died, sadly. Although the brute did go 50, the other one.
Yeah, I believe it still is.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's real old, lovely old fish, that one. But I'd say the nearest one was, well, apart from the, you know, two Woolpack biggies, was the old Nostell Priory big one. But I'm kind of kicking myself because it's a fish I've known about for years and years, just never got off my backside and went to catch it. You know, it's local-ish, probably about somewhere between 30 and 40 miles away from me, which even on its days only, it was easily doable. And it, for me, is, you know, probably still the best big carp Yorkshire has produced.
Mm. Well, let's see which one is Chili's one that got away.
Oh, the one that got away. Oh, dear. Okay, grab your box of tissues, because this will break your heart. I suppose the first thing to say is Keith Jenkins and I followed Dave Lane and Phil Thompson onto Raysbury. The two guys, Phil was still flitting about with it, but Laney had moved on by then. Keith and I went on after a very successful year on Horton, and unfortunately while those Horton fish, or the A-team on Horton, were dying through somebody's ridiculous ideas about restocking the place, we were on Raysbury, and Phil and Dave caught 10 carp in their first year at Raysbury. Keith and I hooked 10 in our first year, but only landed 3, and it just goes to show how fine the line is between being lucky and unlucky. But I was in No Carp Bay, and Keith had just picked up his prize or the week before, where I'd lost mallins. I'd caught mallins before, and I lost it in a rod close in the edge in the corner of the bay. And I was there the following week. Now, don't get mad, get even. I set myself up in exactly the same swim, but I fished it differently. I fished further out into the lake on a little gravel hump. And I got set up by 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and exactly 24 hours later, I got a bite off of that gravel hump. Boats were banned at the time. So I eventually this fish got weeded up very badly, couldn't move it at all, and I blew up a small inflatable boat that didn't want to be inflated, and off I went after the fish. And I could wax lyrical for hours about this before I got to the pain for a bit, but I suppose I should get to the pain. An hour and 45 minutes, I got it off the bottom several times, but eventually the fish came up to the surface, and there's a load of weed around its head, and I could just about make out the damaged tail lobe of the biggest carp in the country at the time, Mary. She's probably around about 55 pounds, I suppose, we'll never know. A lot of the weed cleared, her head came up a little bit, and in the blink of an eye there was almost imperceptible little dink on the line, and I watched her glide away into the depths. My boat was almost uninflated then. I mean, my plan at that point, I had to go back several times to the mainland to blow it back up and go back and play it. And my plan eventually was to stay there as long as I could, get it in the net, and then inflate my life jacket. It was one of the PLPs that we used to use for parachuting, and I would inflate it and then swim to shore with her in the net, and unfortunately it didn't happen. And a month later I was fishing in the drive-in dredger, and I had a bite, and this fish beat me half to death. It was an unbelievable fight, and it got caught in the snag just across the channel to my right, and I went out, and there was my lead core wrapped around a little, there's only a tiny little twig, and below it again was Mary. And I thought, this is it, I've got you now. And as I pushed the landing net down the water, the lead core snapped in half. And once again, she swam away, and I never, ever got near her again. But yes, I have to tell you, that really, really broke my heart.
Oh, I bet it did. I've got the tissues. That is... I think it's better if you don't see them.
Absolutely, because you can convince yourself it's anything but. But on both occasions, I saw which fish it was, and it's... it still hurts so much to this day, but I am capable of laughing about it, and no longer think that I might commit Harry Carey over it. That's the main thing.
Yeah, that must have been a tough one, Mary. Did we have anyone else that lost Mary in the last batch of one that got away?
No, don't think we did.
Did John Matt lose Mary?
I don't know. I'll have to go back and re-listen to that one to see what John Matt lost. But I know he did a lot of time on Raisbury, so it's...
He had most of them. He just didn't have Mario. Yeah. I think it was, you know. I'll have to go back and listen to the previous set of extras. But yeah. Should we move on? Should we see brighten it up a little bit with Ian McMillan?
Yeah, he always brightens my day, does Tingtong.
The one that got away. There's a couple... from totally different parts of the world, and the first one goes back to my Lynch Hill days on Christchurch, and that'd be Pals. I mean, what a fantastic carp, and I still see pictures now of it. Just amazing carp. And you look back, and I think I was so out of my depth, but I soon got to grips with it, and I definitely, because of the distinguished shoulders that Pals had. A tiny little head and a very, very deep body and massive shoulders. I definitely had it feeding off the surface. I can't say that I was convinced that I ever hooked it, but you'll never know. I kind of don't know. But I do feel that until it died, and it was a very unfortunate situation that caused it to die, that I felt I was getting closer. But then I could say that, and there was angles on there that were just as consistent as me, once they sort of got their head around it, that had never caught it, or even angled to caught a lot more fish than me. But then you would get somebody to catch it really quickly. You know, it was a really, really iconic fish that was. And I remember, I think the first picture that really blew my mind was Lee Collins. I think Lee caught it a couple of times. And it was just an amazing fish. But I think if you look back and think, if I knew then what I know now, you would definitely have targeted the upper layers a lot more, but it definitely was one that eluded me. Whether I did lose it and not know, I prefer to know, prefer to remain like that. But yeah, I was really, really in awe of Pals. And a fish that got away, I'm convinced. I did quite a few sessions on the Gravier, which is not prolific as in catching, is Luke Moffat Lake in Dijon. In France, it's a notoriously tricky lake. There's a couple of big fish, 180, 190, the brown fish and the scar, which is a mid 90. And it was a session I'd gone with Clive, and it would become quite weedy, and I'd sort of got my spots rocking, and it was everything was from by a boat. It was where I'd really learned to sort of get to grips with boat fishing and be very confident in fishing around weed and getting them out of weed, and it was where I learned to get the fish out of the weed with my hands rather than relying on the rod. And I was absolutely loving it, and I got my spots rocking. Now, bearing in mind, I'd had fish up to 64 pounder, and I hadn't lost anything because I wouldn't even attempt to land them from the bank. Get by, straight out of the boat, and I loved it. Clive, on the other hand, is absolutely petrified about it and useless, which he would tell you is useless. But I was really, you know, a couple of boat battles in the middle of the night, moon was out, flat calm, just me out in a boat, on my own, just the best place to be. And they would tell you from wee bed to wee bed. And then I've got this bite, and it was on the last night, and it was over the far margin. I was catching right on the far margin, which is probably about 250 yards away, just at the bottom of the shelf. You could see your spot. It was right in line with the pylon. And anybody who's been to Luke Moffat will know this spot, because obviously everybody aims for the obvious spots, and the pylon was one of them. So I've had this bite, straight in the boat. I woke Clive up. Clive would sit under me brolly with a light on, just so I could navigate my way back. We'd sort of got that, we got that part sussed. So I've gone all the way out, got out the first weed bed, and it's basically towed me from one weed bed to another. It wasn't like, bearing in mind I caught a few big ends up to, like I say, you know, near on mid-60, and it wasn't like that fight. It wasn't a quick fight. And I'm not saying the 60-pounder was a quick fight, because the 60-pounder can't move that quick because it's big. Now, this fish was just heavy. It was plodding. And every time you got it out of one weed bed, it would go into another, until eventually it managed to turn me in the boat. And Luke's very, very paranoid about snags, as in branches and twigs and shit like that. And he's obsessive with getting everything out of the water to stop these fish getting tethered up. So the fish has gone left and he's turned me in the boat. and I had no option but to follow it, obviously. And I thought, well, it's just gone into another weed bed. And what it had done, it had basically gone into the far margin and wrapped itself around a twig or a branch, probably one of the only bushes that Luke hadn't pruned, and this fish was underneath it. And I did absolutely, yeah, very much pitch black, got the head torch on. And then eventually, there was no way I was jumping in. Absolutely no chance. I'm not doing that. I'm not risking my life. No fishes as we're far. And then I had no option but to sort of get my hand down as low as I could. I couldn't feel the fish. You know, sometimes you feel the fish come off. The bush roots must have been so thick underneath that it's obviously got in them. Now, I'm convinced that that was one of the big two. Only based on what I'd caught throughout the week. And I'd had a great week, but it did leave a massive bitter taste in my mouth. And we haven't been back since. Not because I've got the art of the place, just because we fish other places in France. And, you know, we like to just travel around. But I'm convinced that that was the brown fish or the scar. Now, I'd like to think that it wasn't because I didn't see it. And obviously, I'd like to think it wasn't because one's 80 yard and one's 90 yard. So I'd like to convince myself that it wasn't, but just the sheer weight. And I've caught a lot of big fish from France, and I've had battles from the bank where there's no weed present, so you can feel the bulk and the sort of head shaking and the thumping of the rod and the heavy lunges. And I've also had a lot of big fish from weed battles. And you just know by the way they move. You know, I remember with Clive Dubois last year, he had an 80-pound common. And as soon as I was watching him playing it, I knew it was a massive fish because it was just going like George towing one of the barrels on top of the sea. It was just moving very slowly. And you just get that feeling, and I'm convinced that was the one that got away. So maybe one day I'll go back to the Gaviers and right the wrong. Unfortunately, I won't get an opportunity at the Petals at Christchurch because she's long gone. But yeah, what a carp. And what carp in the Gaviers.
Yeah, that's one I'd love to fish for, Petals. I don't know why I never went to fish for it. I don't know if it was because of the busyness, the day ticket, you know, the day ticket factor. I think I hadn't done a lot of fishing at the time. I remember it being very much like a plastic fake corn water, or, you know, little bags. I remember reading articles from Ian Poole and stuff at the time, and very riggy fish. And I think I was fishing wire side at the time, and it was my first sort of serious lake. I remember thinking maybe I'm not good enough to go and, you know, fish Christchurch at the time. You know, I was a bit of a boily angler and didn't like doing other stuff, and you know, it very much was another stuff type of fish. And I don't know, did you ever fancy having a go for that one?
It was one that was kind of on the short list, but it was the same era that was when we were going to Elstow.
That's right, yeah.
I went there, I chose Elstow basically because I could go straight down the A1 and be there. You know, going over to Oxford is quite a bit further for me, so, you know, equally as attractive fish and less mileage, which meant less money on fuel, but I'm tight.
And do you fancy yourself having a go for the Gravier's fish?
The fish, yes. The owner, no. Or do you fancy having a go for the owner?
I fancy that I'm probably not welcome there ever again, after making people aware of the uncomfortable fishing conditions that he makes. Along with the fact of it being very expensive, I was never really happy paying that amount anyway, even though I went three times, and it's very expensive for not a complete experience. So sadly, unless he sells the place, I probably won't be going back there. I know he has been trying to sell it for a few years, so you never know. But I was fortunate enough to see it caught, so obviously my friend Reedy caught it while we were there one trip. So it's a pretty amazing sight. Got to see it, but probably will have got away from me, that particular fish. But yeah, but there we go. Who should we have a look at now? Ian Russell.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ! How many do you want to go through? We all lose plenty, didn't we? I lost a big fish. I've run a few fast races. Just minor, tiny little stories. Years ago, I was playing with something called the Bungee Rig, and I went to the manor when it was a hole in a potato field, the one in Essex's, Bollop City, or whatever they call it. Kevin Nash had caught this, I think it was a mid-40 at the time, it was in his Nash Adverts, a big deep fish. Hooked there on a guest overnight with Graham Slaughter, the Graham from Shagger, we used to call him. Lost it by the net. That would have been, for me at the time, my PB was about £30. That would have been like hooking Orca the killer whale. And I didn't repair my mind over that for quite a while. I lost a mid-30 footy scale while filming with Cup TV. Joe Morgan's over my shoulder talking about it. It's one of the Farlows, a really old Farlow fish. I've never caught it. I've seen it once or twice. That was coming up, and then the lead flew over my head. Loads of mid-50 common, probably an upper 50 common last year at a lake in France. Went out in the night in my dinghy with all the life jackets on, and I love that type of fishing. It really is you, a lake, and a fish. It's pitch black. I've got this fish. The night before, I had a 55 mirror. The lake's just bigger than smart if you get a bite. So anyway, I pulled my way out to where this fish is diving around in this weed. Put the rope, the rod across the dinghy, like you do. I've got me pinned down leader now, and I'm gradually, inch by inch, lifting this weed off the bottom. But all of a sudden, vroom, the weed breaks away off the bottom. Up comes this weed with this enormous common. Bear in mind, I had a 55 the night before, so the size is still in my mind. So it was at least that. What I hadn't noticed, over clearly, because I'm concentrating on the fish, is that the line has wrapped around the tip of the rod. You know, it goes all squirrely-whirly. The line is now about a foot down the rod. As this common's broke away, I've let go of the pin down. It's taken up the slack, I've grabbed the rod, and my dinghy moved about 200 miles an hour, where it was like a scene from Jaws when the boat's going so fast, and all of a sudden, the hook straightened, because I couldn't deal with the fish at all, mate. And I was sitting, you imagine then the boat's being towed, and the tower then stops, and the boat just slowly comes to a halt, in the middle of a lake, with a weight the size of a training van, sitting there sulking like a child, mate, so, because I'd seen the fish. So that probably is one of my, because I mean, I kind of class my holiday fish in France the same as I do here. I've gone out and I've made the effort. So to lose a fish of that size is very wounding. One more for you, which this is probably the biggest fish I've ever lost. I've got a year before last, I went for a week on Abbey Lakes Heron with Barry Hearn, Terry's dad. We've been able to get another to fish. Very weedy. I'm out in my little black dinghy again, which again, I love. The nets across my lap, playing these fish, weed bed to weed bed. An enormous weed bed has come up, and I put my hand, I thought, the fish is gone, surely. It was very windy, and it was hard staying close to the fish, because the wind was just blowing her away. Now, this weed bed was huge. I know in the art of art what fish, I didn't see the fish, I put my hand through the weed, felt this fish, and there was no end to this fish. It was absolutely enormous. There's only one in there, or there was at the time, that you all wanted to catch that was that size. A big grey tail came out of the water. This fish bolted down in the hook straightened. And I know which fish it was. It was that shoulders, which at the time was about £95. Barry was sitting on the bank, and when the line went slack, no words were said. I didn't move from that boat for about 15 minutes. I ended up at the other end of the lake almost, where it blew me down there. But although I didn't see that fish, I know, Mark, and you'll know what I mean by that. The size of the flank, I'd had a 60 pounder, and it was enormous comparatively. So I know what it was I lost. And that didn't wound me as much as the common, I've got to say, because she was laying there flat in front of me. But to lose a fish of that magnitude, and then it died about a month later, it hurt me. You know, clearly you want to catch a fish that size because it's in the lake, that's why you go there. So there's a few little tiny minor stories that all add up to me sulking like a child for several hours on end.
Yeah, a little bit of a sickness. I mean, losing shoulders and then it dying. I fancied going to Abbey. I fancied getting a winter ticket on there, actually. Thought about it last year. And obviously, sadly, the fish is gone now. So that opportunity will never be there.
Yeah, I do remember we discussed it on earlier Carpcast as well, didn't we? When you was thinking about it seriously.
Yeah, we did. I believe Ian Russell's out there now, actually, on Abbey, isn't he?
He is there. I noticed on his Facebook earlier he was out there and mentioning the winter ticket, the good company and good fishing. In fact, I'm just going to see if I can pop him up really quick and see where there he is. See where he's been catching. This is a... he shared a picture of Ting Tong with a big daft blue hat on.
Is Ting Tong with him, is he?
I don't know. I think that's from a previous trip. No, oh, right. He's got a couple of pages, Ian Russell, hasn't he? So he's got like a likes page and then his own personal page.
Yeah, I've never been to Abbey. I quite fancy it. Yeah, obviously, you know, it's a bit sad when the biggest fish in the lake dies, but it does tend to quieten down busy lakes when that happens. So
yeah, it does. And you know what happens when the big ones pass? There's always another fish or two that come through the ranks and take the place. But here he is. Hectic little spell this morning on Fox at Abbey. Fish up to £42. Loving the atmosphere on here. Winter VIP ticket is the Nanjas.
Ooh, that's what he's got. It must be the first week of the winter ticket then. Early November, yeah, it used to be. I think Shoulders always used to do a capture as well, the first week in November on the winter ticket. But I remember Max Cottish used to go there a lot in the winters, and he said to me it's fantastic. Sometimes he's like a couple of people on, you know, the entire complex. There's a few lakes there, and it's just heaven. And he's caught, you know, even like -6 in February and stuff. He's had fish, so it's definitely a winter ticket worth getting, I think.
Yeah, is it just a winter syndicate through the wheels? Can you still get trips out there?
I think it's only winter syndicate after November.
Yeah.
But that I makes think sense. You can get a ticket if you apply. One more got away story. Favourite?
I think it's Adam Penning. I think this is one of the great stories from a great storyteller.
Okay. I'll tell you this one. It's if people have seen any of my boring old slideshows, they'll know this story, so apologies if you've heard it, but it's, if you're looking at fish causing you pain, then this is, it didn't technically get away. Well, I'll tell you the story and you can figure out and see if it fits your remit. But so I'm fishing at Raysbury, and Raysbury, as Raysbury actually was, in case any of you lot are listening to this now and you went down there last weekend, I'm talking when it was 120 acres with 40 fish, and was, you know, a very, very interesting challenge. And so I was, again, working Monday to Friday, normal job, go fishing at the weekend, get down to Raysbury Friday afternoon, you know, you're up against it, you go around the M25 from Essex, just having a swig of water because my voice is drying out. I managed to get something going where I managed to get 4 or 5 weekends on the bounce, or certainly 3 or 4, and that was really what you needed up there. You just needed to be in touch with it, with what was going on, and the only way you could do that was by some sort of regularity with your visits, even if you weren't fishing, although I couldn't do that because I wasn't local. So I started to work out where they were going, what they were doing, and it was the autumn, you know, really, you know, good time, obviously, on any carp lake. But also you're thinking, you know, this is the last chance you're going to have until the spring, probably, because Raysbury wasn't the best of winter waters. And I got something going. I kept finding fish in an area at the bottom of the North Lake, sort of between the secret reedy and the diving boards. And they were there quite a lot, and I got there one particular Friday. This was October time, and I've been seeing King Fungus a fair bit, got loads of photographs of him right up close, and I'd seen what area he was living in, and he didn't go in the North Lake very much, if at all. I never actually saw him in the North, but I've got a picture of him with a fish called, what was his name? I'll come back to it in a minute. But it was it was called No Name. Strangely, God, it's like I actually worked that up deliberately with a crap joke. Sorry, it wasn't. It was actually called No Name. So No Name and King Fungus were quite often seen together, and No Name was about low 40. King Fungus was an upper 40. And without going into King Fungus and all his history, just suffice to say he was a very, very, very elusive carp indeed. So I've sort of got the carp tracked down in this area. around the diving board's bottom end of the North Lake, and I'd seen No Name and a couple of the others in the area, Paul Print, I think, and a couple of others, and I thought, do you know what I'm going to do? I'm just going to fish this totally different to the Raysbury way. I'm going to fish it from the bank, I'm going to use the frying stick, and I'm just going to feel for drops out there in the deep water in the silt over the weed, past the weed, I mean, because the weed was thick closer in, and just fish with the frying stick. So that's what I did. So I found these three caught ball. I think I was using cell at the time. I was using cell. So I found these three cell caught balls out where I'd seen these fish shown. Now, the fish were shown with such sort of regularity. I've got pictures of them at home where, you know, you first light, you could see maybe 20 or more shows, you know. It was, I'm pretty sure I saw Malin's show out towards the Dot Island just to my right. Big, big brown fish just after first light. I've got a photograph of the rings dissipating in the mist. It's just one of those sights that just stays with you forever. So I was on the fish, properly on them, and I thought, you know what? I'm going to get one. I'm going to get a Raysbury Leviathan. It's not my times now. I've put in an awful lot of work. It's going to pay off. So I'm fishing. I remember I count everything, whether it's a spod or a spom or boilie. I always keep track of what I put in. I remember I put in 420 boilies with the frying stick, 18 millers, and I spread them over this area where I'd seen the fish fizzing. And then that night there was nobody on Raysbury, which is quite weird because I think this was a Friday night or a Saturday night. Normally, you know, there weren't many. There was only four or five of us that actually fished it hardcore with any regularity, but there was no one else there. It might have been someone on the south, but I think I've been round south in my boat and there was no one on the whole place. And it's got dark. Can't remember if I heard any out. I don't think I did. It was mostly morning you'd see them roll over. So it's got dark and it's gone very, very clear. And I've gone to bed and I'm thinking, this is it. All three rods have gone out perfectly. They've landed in clean silt. Got a good spread of bait out there. It's autumn. I'm on them. Even I can't be that bad that I can't catch one of them, surely. So I've gone to bed with high hopes and gone. I very rarely sleep well on the bank. I'm a bit of an insomniac. But this was one of them times where I'd just gone. I was so tired because it was very, very, took its toll fishing up there. You know, the planes and everything, you know, you're always up early and so I was tired anyway. I wouldn't bore you with a flipping sob story. So I've gone to bed and I'm out. I'm gone. And the next thing I know is the middle rod is in meltdown. I've gone running out sometime in the middle of the night, run out. And again, I'm fishing tight clutches because it's weedy, but it's taking a bit of line, this fish. So I've leant into it. And again, you have this whole pinch yourself, is this reality? Am I really actually connected to a bloody carp? It appeared that I was. So the fish has weeded itself up fairly soon after connecting with it. Just got a flipping mosquito flown into my throat. Hang on a second. Oh my god. Hang on. Oh dear, that was quite a big one. That must be talking a lot if he's flown in there. So I've got my life jacket on, got in the boat, everything's in the boat ready, it was always ready in the boat, the battery's connected, net's in the boat, everything's ready, and I pushed myself off and I pulled myself out to where this fish was weeded up somewhere out in the lake. And I remember going out in the darkness thinking, this is probably my ultimate atmospheric moment, because at Raysbury it was never quiet, it was never silent, because you're near Terminal 5 Heathrow. On the North Lake there's a railway along one bank, the village road was quite noisy, there's always noise, and it was just one of those, it was what the dead of the dead of night. So I went out and I realised there was nothing. There wasn't a single sound. So I guess it was probably somewhere about 2 a.m. or something, that dead zone. And excuse me. So I pulled myself out there, and I remember the feeling, the boat, the motor, everything was coated in moisture. It wasn't frost, it was cold, and there was this big moon up there, clear sky, flat calm, and clinging with dew. So I pulled myself out to where the line was stuck, and got over and I'd leant on it a bit, and I felt something kick, and it came up in the water, and then it sort of towed me along a little bit, and then it's gone round the other side of the boat, and you know, and it was an all time great angling moment, and you know, the hairs go up on the back of my neck now just thinking about it, because you don't know what you could be attached to. You're there on one of the most awe inspiring historical waters in history of fishing, and you're on your own. There is no one, and it's totally silent. All you can hear is the clutch of your 5,000 T or 6,000 T, sorry, just going tick, 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 as it takes a bit more line. And well, it went off quite a while. Eventually, I've got it up near the surface, and there was a lot of weed on the line, and I had to put the head torch on to clear it. And as I did, I saw this big pale shape. And I thought, oh my God, Jesus Christ. As Simon Scott would say, oh my Godfathers. I don't know why he says that. It always makes me laugh. So I thought, oh my Godfathers. And I thought it was near the surface. So I've put the rod behind me and pushed the net out. And just as it's about to go in the net, I've got it up, and it's there in the moonlight. And it's sort of boiled. And just as it's about to go in the net, it went in the net, which I couldn't believe, because I thought, like you probably did, that it was going to come off. I was convinced of it. And I thought, oh my God, it's gone. It's in the net. I've caught it. So I brought it to the side of the boat, and I've looked down, and there's this whacking great mirror carp laying in the bottom of the net. And I thought, well, I secured it to the boat, and then I've just put the outboard on two clicks on the silent electric motor. And I just slowly started making my way into shore under the moon and the stars. And you're just thinking, I'm looking up and I'm thinking, I've done it. No matter what happens, I've done it. It can't be taken away from me now. No, it's there. It's in my net. It's happened. So I'm pootling in towards shore, and I'm thinking, right, who am I going to ring in the morning? You know, you start planning and you're thinking, this is just incredible. This is such a special moment. Who do I want to share it with? And so I'm going, all these thoughts are going through my mind. I've got to the shore, jumped out of the boat, water was freezing, went round the side of the boat, looked in the net, and he was still there, sat there quietly at the bottom of the net, and all right, I secured him to the back of the boat, and I went and sorted out the mat, the scales, the sling, all the things that you never need at Raysbury, but you still carry just in case. And so I've got the fish, and it... To be, you cannot, I'm feeling like Muhammad Ali when he won the world heavyweight title for the third time. I'm feeling like every sporting great moment you could ever imagine all rolled into one, where you think, I've done it. It's there. It's lying at my feet. My ultimate angling achievement. It's here. I've flipping well done it on a weekend against the odds, blah, blah. And as I've gone to move the fish from the net to the sling or something I was doing, I lifted the fish, and I'd already checked for the rig, and it seemed to come out in the net. I couldn't feel it around the mouth of the fish, so I thought, it must be in the net. Well, I need to check. So when I've gone to move the fish, the line come with the fish. I thought, what's going on here? And so I rolled the fish over, and the hook was firmly embedded in a scale just behind its peck, buried up to the hilt. And I looked at it and I just thought, no, it's very hard to it's impossible to describe how you can go from hero to zero, to go from like your greatest angling moment to total crushed worm. And I sat there and I looked at it with my head torch, and I just thought, oh, I can't. Well, there's no one there, but I didn't know what to say. I didn't know what to think. I didn't know what to do. So I got the hook out as carefully as I could, which was almost impossible because it was obviously a barbed hook, and the scale, I couldn't get it out without the scale coming with it. So I got it out, and I put some medication on the fish. I took a picture of it lying on the mat, I don't know what I did, but I did. Took a picture of it laying on the mat, and then I rolled it up in the sling, and I waded out to about mid-fire depth, or just above my knees, with this beast, and held it until it was ready to swim away, and then I watched it waddle off in the moonlight, and that was, although I didn't lose it, you know, at that moment I had lost everything, you know, it was the ultimate crushing moment in my angling life, because you believed you've achieved everything, and then you have it all snatched away, and that was quite a hard one to take. But there you go.
I wonder how many people would have been as honest as Adam, and I wonder how many I can name a few what we might call money anglers, you know, people who like keeping themselves in the profile, and fishing's about ego and money to them. Names shall remain nameless, and I'm pretty sure they'd have counted that fish and nobody would have known any different.
Yeah, I'd probably done the same as I might have weighed it and slipped it back in that, but it's gutting, you know. I remember on back in Elster, one of the fellas catching the unattended, you know, and regular 40, you know, he's hooked in the peck, and you know, he just looked, there was no obvious marks in the mouth where the hook had been, and no pictures, slipped it back, catalogue. But it's one of those silent moments, you know, where you just, it's gone from wow, he's caught a 40 to everyone just like slowly melts away from the swim just to leave him alone.
I'll tell you one of the most gutting ones, a chap called Simon, you may remember on St Ives, apologies for mentioning the lady twice.
Cy Giblin,
who's yes, really, he spent years hunting the lady, and he really struggled that particular year, like really struggled, don't think he'd had a fish. Then he ended up landing a fish, giving it the shout, lady! Everybody came round to the swim. He's picked the net up once everybody's there in front of everybody, everyone congratulating him and everything, picked it up, and it was trailing. He'd hooked another line. It had somebody else's rig in its mouth. I forget the chap that lost it. A chap lost a fish casting long, didn't he, in the old lake,
yeah.
If you remember, to the yeah. second bar, was it? Super long range?
Yeah, I can't remember if it was. Were you there when Cy landed it?
I don't know if it was on the lake. I was certainly fishing at that time.
Yeah, I do remember that happening. But karma paid him back. He did eventually land the lady a top weight of just over £60.
Yeah, karma. But, I mean, you know, it's fair play to him. I mean, that must have been a sickness. I mean, he's given the shout-out lady and you know, had the congratulations. Everyone's round there shaking his hand and whatever. And then, bang, they spot that it's been foul-hooked. Well, not in foul hook, just had somebody else's rig yeah. in its mouth. I mean, to be fair, when the chap that lost it at range, when he heard that story, he probably felt just as sick, and this same story yeah. would be his one that got away, I guess.
Yeah, you can't pass that one off as a tench.
No. Was it a Chodrig? It was in the early days of the Chodrigs, I'm sure.
I have no idea what rod, what nod.
Yeah, possibly I might just have plucked that out of thin air and made it up. I'm hoping to get fishing myself this week. We're still in autumn, because I don't think it's winter till December, but it's early November as we're recording this, and the water's definitely gone cold. We seem to have bypassed autumn, haven't we? Those nice sort of warm easterlies and southerlies you get in the autumn, all the leaves off the trees. We haven't had any of that. We went from summer to cold northerlies, cold easterlies, and the fish have just shut up shop for maybe 6 weeks everywhere, or pretty much everywhere.
Yeah, definitely been hard fishing, and now, like I said on the main podcast, I'm giving the folly, the Peterborough Syndicate, a bit of a break. It's that time of year when leaves fall, and I've never fished a small water that fishes after it's had a lot of leaf litter go in it. You know, it's something happens. It's again when we need to a question we need to put to the carp Simon Scott, but I'm sure there's something with the breakdown of all the leaves landing that puts the carp off, maybe changes the pH or something. But it's been fishing really, really hard,
and a lot of places have. So, but things are turning round. You say it's, today early on it was like 10 degrees in Blackpool.
Yeah, well, I was driving around after dark and it was 11.5, I think. We've got 2 days coming up on the supermoon, which I don't know if I've ever really fished on the supermoon, which is obviously the full moon at its closest it's ever been to the Earth in like a century. I don't know if that what sort of effect that has on the fishing, but I do know we've got decent weather, so I wasn't planning to fish this week, but I'm going to try and get out. Lakes have certainly started turning on. I know Cromwell for one did about 10 fish in 24 hours when that's been very slow. Some friends of ours, Roger Bacon and all the gang, they're down on Farlow's, just arrived today. I really think there's going to be some fish caught this week. It's maybe just because of the warm weather and more importantly the lack of crap weather. I mean, lots of lakes haven't fished. We discussed on the normal podcast that lots of lakes haven't fished for such a long time that, you know, owners were getting worried about their fish. And I think a combination of the weather getting better and just the fact that these fish haven't eaten for 6 weeks, I think stuff's going to happen this week. And maybe the super, maybe we'll all say, yeah, it's the moon, it's the moon. But really, it's just that fish haven't eaten for 6 weeks.
Yeah, I mean, fish are cold-blooded. You know, basically they are solar powered. That's why I like to think of them. And with a rapid cooling of the water, it's not going to sit well with the carp. They are they're going to go a bit dormant or what have you. But when the, you know, the lake it settles cold, or even goes back up a degree or two, that's when you catch carp. And I'm expecting the same as you. People catch carp this weekend and they'll not think about the temperature. They'll blame it on the big ball of cheese.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I think they had a shock with it going super cold very quick. You know, we've had frost, quite a few frosts. I mean, last year, I think our first frost was like February last year.
And, last year was silly mild.
Yeah, we're not even halfway through autumn and we've been getting quite a few frosts and it's been, you know, it's been bitter. Even going out in the daytime, been wearing coats. You know, it's almost t-shirt weather this time last year. And I think it's just shocked the fish, sent them down, combination of things with the ammonia levels rising because people putting bait in when they don't realise the fish aren't feeding because they should be this time of year. Probably got people that have decided, right, I'm going to heavy bait all autumn and get that big hit. And obviously conditions have changed. Just a whole load of factors contributed to the fact that you know, it's made fishing conditions really, really difficult. So I think now they've got used to this shock and the weather's warming a bit, just like you say, I think there's going to be fish caught this week. And I hadn't planned to go fishing. I wasn't fishing again till the end of November, but I think I'm going to try and get out this week. I'm going to ring Kevin tomorrow, see if he'll let me on one of his lakes. You got any tactics you're using for this time of year now the water's colder? Obviously, I think we've missed the big feed, haven't we? I don't think there's any point in filling a lake in. But you got any plans?
Yeah, this is what I would suggest to everyone. And, you know, if anyone out there tries it, give us some feedback. Let us know how you get on. Sweet corn. And I'm not just talking about a tin or two. I'm talking about a kilo or three or four.
Yeah.
Most of sweet corn is made up of water. You know, whatever the bait you're using, mix it 50-50 with that, because that's exactly what I'm doing. You know, along with my nice milky boilies, you know, a bit of, you know, the spod mix gloopy gluggy stuff they put with it, and a hell of a lot of yellow grains. You know, it's visual, and it goes straight through them. It is very digestible for the fish. They just crap the skins out and then eat some more.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, particles at this time of year is always a method. I mean, I've quite often fished 50-50 particles and boilies all year round anyway. But I do know at this time of year that you don't really want to fill the fish up because the water's colder, they're digesting food much slower than they will do.
Exactly.
In warmer water, so you want to prolong feeding periods, not have them, you know, suck two mouthfuls of boilies up and be full up straight away and feeling lethargic and not hungry. You want them to feed as long as possible, give yourself the best chance of catching. So sweet corn I like. I mean, I've been through stages where I've always fished, you know, sort of 10 tins of sweet corn into like 3 kilos of boilies, mix it all up and put it out. You know, I've done that a lot over the years.
Yeah, and it works. And do you know what? I mean, this is something I do. I mean, I've been out and bought 20 kilos of sweet corn the last time we went shopping. You know, you use your kilo bags out the freezer. You know,
the wife's looking for, you know, frozen veg, and I'm just filling the tray with the trolley up with sweet corn, and she knows what I do. She just looks and shakes her head now. But yeah. In the shop, we've got these new booklets that Corda have put out, you know, just autumn tactics, and, you know, obviously lots of products in there to buy. Daryl Peck's got a short article where I think it doesn't say which lake, one of the Oxford ones he just mentioned, but he gets to about 15 kilo of sweet corn. I was reading it thinking, and, well, when you read someone like Daryl using something that you would do as well, it kind of puts a smile on your face. It justifies yourself that you're on the right track. It's one like Daryl does the same.
Yeah, for sure. Full show. Shall we move on? Oh, before, just talking about the cold water, I think I'm going to have a go at like a milk proteiny type bait, the Nash Citrus range, which is like a higher track range, very pink. They do the cultured hook baits and a fizzing stick mix, and that's super milky in the water, and I'm always going to have that on one rod, I think, when I go fishing. I like a sweet, high attracty type bait with not much food around it. So I'm certainly going to be fishing like that on my anchor rigs and anything a little bit tricky. But yeah, that's my plans. And plenty of particle, plenty of sweet corn, the same as you. So
sweet corn is cheap.
Yes, certainly. we asked everybody, all our guests, we asked them about disaster sessions. We've had a few ourselves, haven't we, Mark? You had any recently?
I don't know if I mentioned it on the main cast, but I actually fell in not too long back for the first time in quite a while, actually.
Yeah.
But, I was just, stripped down. I've got my pants and T-shirt, thinking if I just wade out a short way, only a few feet, literally, I can just get the angle around the tree and get the bait where I want. The water that looked about 6 inch was probably about a foot of water, and nearly that again in silt. So I basically have fallen flat on my face straight in the drink. But the best thing about it, nobody saw me. So I may have just made that up.
Did you come home, or did you stay there?
I'll be daft. I stayed there. I stayed in my pants for about an hour while I got the rod sorted.
Yeah, which I've been
a horrendous sight, to be honest.
I don't know if I've had any disaster sessions of late. I mean, I've had lots and lots over the years, but I don't know if I can't think of any super nasty ones. I mean, I did come home early from fishing a few weeks ago. It wasn't quite a disaster session, but I just didn't feel right. You know, wasn't happy fishing. Not really in tune. Obviously the lakes were fishing crap, and it's just one of them where it's just like, get me home, I don't want to be here. Wasn't enjoying my time, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was about it, I think. But let's who are we going to have Mark pick somebody
for the disaster? Well, I know Steve Briggs is quite an epic one, so I should save that one for last, I think. But we finished off with Adam. Should we start with Adam again?
Yeah, let's get Adam back in.
Well, this is a bit of a short one, really. I can't think of any sessions where... No. That's not true, actually. I was going to say, actually, far from being an angler who doesn't have things go wrong, I have things go wrong on such a regular basis. It's hard to think of any particular instances, because I am fraught with disaster one way or another. But there was one session that... sticks in my mind as being a real sort of low point at that time. I was fishing a pit out near Ongar in Essex on a date on a club ticket, and I was I just caught my personal best. It was 1987. I was 16. Oh, I was driving, so I must have been 17. What age can you drive at? Is it 17 or 18? Can't have been 18. Yeah, so this was about 1987, and I caught this amazing personal best mirrors. I've still got a picture of it now. It was awesome fish, 15 pound 4 ounces, which was a personal best. And I'd found that lunch and meat and hemp was the deadliest combination possible. And so I used to put a few handfuls of hemp down in the in these gravel patches near the reeds, and then hair rig a bit of lunch and meat over the top. So I caught this 15 pounder, and I'd had a few others as well on the 16th of June, the previous week. And then I've gone back full of, expectation. You know, I've just caught these fish and a 15 pound carp, you know, that was, you know, it was a personal best, you know, it was a big fish for me then. And, so I've gone back, and, this time I'm armed with, Christ and multi-strand. And I'm thinking, right, I've got some multi-strand. I'm properly going to make a monkey out of these carp even more than I did last week. So I've gone down there, got my rod sorted out, and but the fish weren't there. They were just, I don't know where they gone, but I couldn't find them. I put a bit of hemp down and a bit of lunch of meat. And anyway, I've got a fish in. I didn't have any waterproofs or a brolly, and you guessed it, absolutely... It just came down like movie rain. And so I sat there and I'm thinking, bloody hell, it's just dripping off my nose. And I've decided to recast one of the rods, and I've wound it in, and it's just tangled to just beyond belief. What's going on here? So then I've put a new bit of lunch, I've untangled, put another bit of lunch meat on, cast it out. Then I've got the other rod, and I'm walking it down the margin to this. Then that was tangled to hell, just destroyed. So I've sorted that out now. I've repositioned that, and then eventually, after a while, about in the afternoon, I've had a bite, and the monkey climber has gone smashing up into it, and the reel's gone churning it away on backwind, lifted into this fish, and had it on for quite a while, a good 10 minutes or so. And I remember seeing it, thinking it was the biggest carp I'd ever caught. It was probably 17 pound or something. It looked massive. And I've just got it over the edge of the net, and a flipping hook came out, and the rig's gone flying over behind me, and landed in the bushes, and I couldn't believe it. I was absolutely soaking wet, lost my biggest ever carp, couldn't seem to cast anywhere without getting tangles from this multi-strand stuff. So in the end, I packed up, I've taken everything back to the car. Which was it was a Mark II Escort, my first ever car. It was a red one, 1977 plate, and I've got my gear, put it in the car, and at the time I used to play a lot of badminton. I used to play in a local sort of club stroke league, and there was this guy, Bill Hitch's name was. He's dead now, rest his soul. And don't know why I said that. I'm not religious. Anyway, Bill's dead. He was a lovely bloke, and so Bill Hitch used to take us to badminton a lot of days, and he was a real dour, surly sort of guy. He had a really good, wicked sort of black sense of humour. Anyway, Bill used to have this Volvo 345 GLE, I think it was, proper old one. And it's about 1987, like I said. And whenever Bill was taking us to badminton, his fuel light would be on all the time. And I'd always go, Bill, you're going to run out of petrol. He'd go, no, it'll go for miles like that, boy, don't you worry. And it did. He never, ever ran out of petrol. So I assumed that was the same for all cars. So anyway, I've got to the car park, thrown all my gear in the car. I'm soaking wet. It's about 15 miles drive home. Started the car, and I've looked at the needle. I thought, oh, I'm doing a bill. It wasn't a Volvo, so I didn't have a fuel light that come on, but the needle was below the red and practically resting on my left knee. And I'm thinking, I don't know if Bill would have took it this low. I don't know. I thought, well, it's I'm pushing my luck here, so I'm just going to get home as quick as I can before it runs out. So that's what I did. So I raced home as quick as I could. Obviously, the worst thing you could possibly do. And about 2 miles up the road, I put down or ran out of petrol. And then I had to walk about 2 miles to a farmhouse to get them to take me to a station and get a can. Anyway, the whole thing was just an angling day of disaster. And when I did get home sometime later, I properly felt I had my tail between my legs. So there you go.
I remember back to the 80s when I was first learnt to drive, and you know, an old banger in them days is very different to an old banger now. I think if you've got 500 quid to spend on a car now, you're probably going to get a car that's, you know, all right. You can get quite a lot for your money these days, whereas the way technology was sort of back in the late 80s, like, you know, even the good cars weren't fantastically reliable. And if you had 500 quid, I think a Mark II Escort was my first ever car, and that used to break down every winter whenever it was cold. It had everything go wrong with it over the years, you know, head gasket, all sorts of stuff that rarely goes wrong on cars these days, you know, radiator leaks, overheating. All sorts of stuff could sort of problems that don't crop up too often these days on vehicles. But I've lost count of the amount of times you've gone back to the vehicle, and you know, like carrying your gear back to the vehicle, you know it's 50-50 is your best shot of actually your car starting. And then you get times where, you know, 100% of the time you get back to it and it won't start for whatever reason. And I had so many of those sessions fishing where you just, you know, is it an RAC phone call or whatever, just dreading it and waiting for ages to get home, or breaking home on the motorway. I had that a lot of times.
Yeah, we don't mind breaking on the way home. It's when you break down on the way to the lake, that's bad. That's the disaster.
Yeah, definitely. I'll tell you one disaster actually that I've completely forgot about until just now.
Is this going to be involving Roger?
No, that's another one. Maybe do that one in the next break, actually, because that was somebody definitely. Else. That was somebody else's disaster. No, this one was somebody else's disaster caused by me, actually.
Confession time.
Just remind me of that Escort. My friend Glyn used to drive me fishing in the Horseshoe days before I could drive when I was like 16, up until I passed my test, basically. I used to go with him. And then I remember I'd passed my test now, so I must have been 17, so 1989 it would have been. And he's booked a week off work, I've got a week to fish. I can't remember where I was working in those days, probably stacking shells in the supermarket or something. And we've been looking forward to this week in the summer on Horseshoe for ages and ages. And he'd bought new rods. He'd had some Northwestern 2¼ through action jobbies, which were the all singing, all dancing ones. I think it was Foster's of Birmingham used to make them. They had a rod builder there. I had a set from there as well, but this is before I had the money to do that. And we've got there and the lake's rammed. I forget why. I think there might have been, you know, one of them Carp Society weekends or something like that on there. This is before the Carp Society owned the lake, but they still used to do the fishings and stuff. And I remember it being absolutely rammed. There was no swim, so we've been excited for this week's holiday for ages, and we've got there. There's basically nowhere to fish, or we're waiting for this weekend to finish whatever. And we've set up on the main point as you're driving in. Used to just be a normal fishing area then. I think it's all roped off now as like a separate area. But we drove onto there, and we've ended up sleeping the night in the cars because we could get in whatever swims on the point the next day, and there was quite a few fish there in the weed. And for some reason, Glyn's put his rod bag under my car so he can like lie down and sleep in the passenger seat. Anyway, in the morning, I forget what happened, whether we were going to go and get some breakfast or he called me over to talk to him, and it was freezing cold. It was like, you know, 5 a.m. or something. And I've reversed my car to pull up next to him so we could talk through the window, just as he shouted, "No!" As I've like basically driven over his rod bag, I've smashed all of his reels and all of his rods. Right at the start of a week session, he was fuming. I don't think he ever forgave me to this day. It ruined the trip. He basically had to drive to Leamington Spa, which is probably about an hour and a half away, and he ended up borrowing a set of rods, but it just put a dampener on the week. Like he wasn't happy. He ended up getting the reels fixed. They sent them back to, they were the original bait runners 6010s or 8010s, whatever they were. He ended up getting them fixed off Shimano a few weeks later. I think he had to buy some new rods. I paid him back many, many years later. He moved to Canada. He met a girl online, ended up marrying her, I think, and he's lived in Canada for quite a lot of years now. And I remember his mum was seriously ill; she was dying, and he didn't have the money to come back over to visit her. And I was quite flush at the time, so I remember sending him probably the equivalent of what them rods earn, you know, a few hundred quid. Ended up sending him 300 quid or something to get back. So that was my karma paid. I mean, he had a few quid in those days. He used to earn a lot of money, so it wasn't really the money he was pissed about. It was, you know, smashing his rods at the start of this week's session. And that was a bit of a disaster session, actually. The fish were all in the weed close in. And, you know, obviously pre-chod rigs. This is like 1989, I think it was. Maybe 1990 at the very latest. And the weed was to the surface. And people were, the guys that were on before us were getting bites in the weed, just casting into the weed, but they kept losing them. And exactly the same thing happened to me. I got on the left hand side of the point, and we were trying to make like helicopter rigs, but in those days we were using, remember the stiff anti-tangle tubing, like the black plastic stuff that was rigid.
Oh yeah, you used to buy an inline lead with the, about 18 inch of it stuck out the end.
Exactly, yeah. So I remember, and there was another version where you could clip a lead onto it. Had like a little plastic black spigot, and you could actually slide it up and down the black bit. So I was putting the lead at the bottom of it and sliding like the bit where you'd quite often put a lead on, putting the rig onto that at the top of it, so it was like a helicopter base. It was kind of like a chod, but it was using a normal rig. Anyway, I was casting this into the weed, and I was getting bite after bite, and I lost every single one of them. Must have lost 10 fish plus, just not hooking them properly, basically getting screaming take and nothing happening, or nothing being there, or it bumps off straight away, or I don't really know what was happening. My mind wasn't as problem solving in those days as maybe it is now.
Yeah. But you say pre-chod, I think that's something you should ask Frank Warwick, because we'd have to get him back on again and have another rig discussion, because he actually invented it back on, I believe it was Cuttle Mill years back, and it was called the silt rig back then.
Yeah.
Don't know what the timeline is on that one.
No, well, yeah, we'll find out. I mean, I fished Cuttle Mill in those days as well, sort of 1990s. First time I ever heard of the stiff rig. Not Terry Hearn's stiff rig, but like a long, stiff hook link. Oh, no. I had a dream. Oh, dear. I had a dream about a rig. It's just come back to me now. I'm dreaming about fishing. What does that mean? I haven't done that since I was a kid.
It means you're on one.
Getting the, oh no,
the drive is coming.
I had a dream that I invented the perfect rig. It was like, you know, with Roger, we were talking about ejecting on the blowout, so having some sort of rig. It was like on a rail in my dream. Like, imagine like a train track, and the end bit, the end stiff bit of your rig was like a train track, and this boilie was on some metal contraption that was a track to these two rails, and it was stiff at the end, and when they blew it out, it just went along these rails all the way back. I mean, it's an impossible rig to make, but why has that just come to me now? That's weird.
That is weird. I was looking forward to seeing this rig.
I'm gonna have to try and design it now. It was like rigid metal, almost like imagine like two just bits of thin metal. So imagine like a paper clip or something straightened out, two of them next to each other, with the bait attached to like something that runs up and down them. I don't know. It was somehow a rig. But this is not. I don't want to be dreaming about fishing. I'm 40 odd years old. It's not good. Right, let's get somebody else's disaster in. Who are we going to have?
Oh, should we have one of the Ians?
Okay, Ian Russell. Let's find out.
Bloody hell, I get more in these days than I don't. Well, it all went wrong. You can't have hundreds of them, mate. I thought we all had, haven't we? Because it
if it went right every time, we wouldn't have been doing it, mate. Well, I'll tell you what, I'll just talk about the last trip I've had. Two nights on Horton, on the fish, nothing. Absolutely nothing. I mean, Dave Levy's whizzing around that lake and he's had like 5-6 40s now. Dave is a phenomenal angler. And I certainly know how to catch a fish myself, but sometimes it just isn't rolling your way and you have a lean spell. I'm in that. 48 hours on Horton, reeled in the morning, packed up, went for a walk round K1 with me, mate. Found them. I thought, you know what, I ain't got to be home yet. I'll do the day. We may had a 30-odd pounder straight away. I sat all day with, and I was on the phone to Ann, our media guy from Avid, and I stopped talking. I went, oh my, I said, that's a 45-pound fish. It's just come right out of the water, boof, on top of one of my baits. And you're looking for somewhere to take the photos, aren't you? Nothing. I came home at 4 o'clock. Absolutely. I'd fished harder from 10 o'clock till 4 than I had the 48 hours before. But it, just incredible. Moving rods, moving swims. And I thought, do you know what? They're still here. I'm going home because I've done two nights and it's not fair on my home life. Nice dinner, nice bath, evening with Debbie. 4 in the morning, I was back on that lake. Someone had picked me and moved into the swim. So I set up in the next swim, and like a fool, I had a doctor's appointment at 1 o'clock. So I set up in the swim next to where I was, thinking they can't be far off. Shut my mouth a couple of hours, saw nothing, wheeled in, shot to the doctors, took about 45 minutes to get to the doctors, got back, stood on the bridge at Kingsmead. They're showing the furthest point away you could get on Kingsmead. And again, you all do it and think, phew, buggers. That's why you've got fins, isn't it? So I went to the swim, Bibby, everything on the barra. Half a mile later, I'm in this swim, seeing the odd fish, threw them out, they'd moved. Now I'm halfway back up the bank between where I first started and I'm now fishing. So I load the barrel again. I hadn't put the bloody bibby up, thank God. There's two of us doing this with two barrelfuls of gear as high as a camel's hum. We've ended up back in pegs 14 and 15, and that's where they stayed. I still only got one fish. So I had done more miles than I've ever done in my life with a full barrel. And I do enjoy this style of fishing, but usually with a lot less gear in my barrel. And I ended up with a 20, and my mate ended up with another 30 and lost a big one. So his luck was in. Mine was out, but I can honestly say, it was like a day trotting on the river. You're working constantly. You're not at rest, chopping and changing, and you know there's a bite to be had. And sometimes, no matter how hard you try, Mark, it don't come, does it? It just doesn't come, mate. But I did have a 20, which was a consolation prize. But there was on the wind, and this was a freezing cold normally. They shouldn't have been on the... Everything that they shouldn't have been doing, they were doing. And everything they should have been doing, they weren't doing. So that's my last trip now that I've just got home from, so sod the place. I will be back the next week because I love it over there. It's so addictive over there, but loads of big ones, mate, they get you. But well, I mean, I've got loads of them stories, as we all have, but that's the easiest one to recount because I've just flopped myself on the bed after getting home from it. I made a DVD, me and Milky, a Foxport thingy with Len Gerd. The week before I'd been in hospital, I'd had a hernia operation, so I've got stitches all across my front. So in this DVD, I'm in a stationary swim because I can't hardly bloody walk. I walk like Ozzy Osbourne. Milk is zipping around the lake. Anyway, done the video, DVD, whatever, brilliant. I'm doing one more night with Gail just to have a social, really. It's 10 foot of water in my swim, right off the edge. I pulled my phone out to phone the missus, and it's flipped up in the air. It's doing somersaults. You've done it yesterday. You're watching it thinking, ah! It's gone plop. Now, 10 foot on the bottom, I can see the light on. And I'm like, no way. Stupidly, within 5 seconds, I'm in my pants, and I'm on the bottom in 10 foot water, grubbing around. I'm up again. Milky, this is all happening so fast, Milky's like, what the bloody hell is he doing? I've hit the surface. I'm down again, thinking, if I don't find it this time, I've lost it. And tapping the animal on the bottom because I didn't open my eyes because I was a bit scared of that. Yeah. Anyway, I managed to grab this phone. It didn't work, unfortunately, like yours did, but I got the phone, threw it out. It's like the man from Atlantis going, breaking the surface, throwing this phone on the bank, mate. But there you go. And then I thought, shit, I've got stitches in my front. So I had to go back to hospital the next day to get all that clean. It was a nightmare, mate. But it did, great DVD, by the way. But the aftermath was, I wish Len had still been there with the camera. Can you imagine that? Bloody hell, mate. But my phone wasn't as lucky as yours, and you're very lucky with that, mate.
Yeah, I was definitely lucky, and I was lucky, otherwise Tom would have been lost, and he wouldn't be having a feature in the next Crafty.
Well,
Actually, that might have been quite lucky if you yeah. If he hadn't turned up, you could have gone home earlier and missed all the bleeding rain.
Yeah, there is that, but that's just the way things went. Yeah, I was sat there just thinking, just looking at the rods while he's there with his camera doing all these, you know, shots with different angles and different activities and pouring some glue on your boilie shot. And he says, do you want to do a shot where you're wrapping your sticks up? And I was like, well, how many of them have you done this week?
You know? Yeah, well, that is it, isn't it?
Yeah. But,
so we missed the start off that second story, but Ian had told his first story, hadn't he, Mark? And then just through general conversation went into another.
Yeah, well, we were chatting about, I'd recently dropped my phone in the lake. It was when I was giving directions to Tom from Crafty to come out and do a feature with us, do his pictures, and I had a drop back while I was on the phone to him, dropped the phone in the panic to get to the rod and dropped it in the lake. So Tom's driving around Lincoln, hasn't got a clue where to go, and my phone's knackered. And then that's when Ian started telling me about his little disaster dropping the phone in, so I quickly pressed record again just to get that, but I'm glad I did.
Let's have a chat with Jacko.
Right, on your list you said that one. We've got that one on my list for some reason.
Sorry, maybe you didn't copy. Just have a think.
I've had loads of sessions where it's just gone wrong, you know. You just know you shouldn't be there, you know, you're in the wrong swim, I've left your rods indoors or something like that, and you know, and there's been, I mean, again, because I'm predominantly a short session angler, especially in the earlier days of my carp fishing, you know, when you've got down there, it's freezing cold, and you've walked to the far end swim of the lake. You know, you've walked about a mile with your tackle and everything, and it's all gone tits up. And then it's, yeah. And there's been loads and loads of times I've sat there and I've thought, and thinking about the walk back to the car or the van, and thinking, do you know what? I'll be really glad when I'm fed up of all this, you know, and nothing's going right. You haven't caught anything, or you know, and so I've had loads of sessions like that, but you know, but no, but then again, you know, the next day you're inspired again, you want to go down there for another go, and but no, I've had loads of sessions where I thought, I wish I hadn't come, you know, and you know, and you know, I wish I could, you know, get this carp fishing malarkey out of my head, you know, and do something else, you know, be like a normal person, because I ain't normal sometimes. I mean, I've been fishing down the lake when the lake's been froze over, you know, just because, you know, there's, you know, it's just for the sake of being down there, and you know, I've been down there, all the lakes frozen over apart from a little 20 yard stretch in front of me, you know.
Yeah.
And thought, you know, I don't know, I'm absolutely mad, and but sometimes I think it helps to be mad, but again, it's just that little open in my head all the time that I might catch one, you know. And so but deep down I know I'm not gonna, I know it's, I'm on a loser, you know, but no, there's been loads of times when I've thought, you know, it's been a disaster session for one reason or the other, you know.
Do you ever get that feeling sometimes when you sat there, you're cold, you're damp, you feel like you're wasting your time, and you're just thinking, what am I doing with a little round ball in the middle of a lake, and you know, trying to catch some fish that's swimming about? And I don't know, sometimes you get those.
There's been loads of times when I thought to myself, if I could just flick a little switch now and be home indoors, you know, quick as that, you know, I would do. But then, because you know, when you're down there on them sessions, and then you've got, you know, it's grueling getting to your swim anyway, you know, it's a bit of a grueler, because, you know, and then, so, you've got a grueler of a walk back to you, you know, when you pack up, and I just sat there and I thought, I would like to flick a switch and then end up back indoors, you know, but,
little time travel machine and a ferry to pack your gear up.
I'll leave it there, you'll see you at home.
We've all been there, cold, wet, damp, numb hands, and then you've still got to pack everything up, put it in, you know, on a barrow or carry it. And in fact, you were the first person I ever saw with a motorised barrow when many years ago now. I remember seeing a picture of you somewhere in a magazine or whatever, but yeah, when Was it Prestige made the first motorised one?
Motorised barrel was actually my idea. Before he ever got involved with selling them, he came to us. The Tackle Box was the first ever people to sell
the cart porters.
Like the cart porters, and it was actually me that thought of the name cart porter. And Alan came to us for advice, and we told him a few little tweaks he ought to do. So then a couple of years later, I said to him, "You ought to do a motorised one, based on the disabled or a golf trolley or a disabled thing, you know." And he did. But I must admit, the motorised trolley is good, motorised bar is good, but you know, it's. And it made life easier at times, except when it broke down, because that happened a number of occasions, you know. But I think he's got his act together now. But now I use a normal push barrow, you know, I find it just as easy. You know, yeah. I think half the problem is sometimes we take too much gear, don't we, you know, and everything's gotten so much bigger. Unhooky mats are bigger than they used to be, sleeping bags are bigger than they used to be, and so I've tended to cut my gear down a little bit. That's just using not a normal barrel, like a normal cart porter. You know, I still think the cart porter idea is great, you know, in comparison to a normal copper wheelbarrow.
How many times have you wished you could flick that switch, Mark, and just transport yourself home, all the gear packed up in the van, motor, whatever, journey home, sat down chilling on the Sunday night back at home?
Yeah, every now and then, but on the flip side, how many times have you been stuck at home wishing you were at the lake fishing?
Yeah, I guess. This week would definitely be like that if I can't go for whatever reason. I've got a Skype meeting at 2:30 tomorrow, and I'm hoping I can get fishing somewhere afterwards, but you never know.
I'm off this week. I've got the chiropractor tomorrow evening, just trying to stop my arm from falling off, and it was probably good because it stops me going hiking and slinging leads 130 yards, which doesn't do my shoulder any good whatsoever.
The trouble is, I mean, somehow you always end up picking the weeks not to go fishing where everything happens. I think it's been a trend of that for the last 10 years for you.
I totally blame the wife. Her birthday is the 4th of August. Every year she thinks, let's have 2 weeks holiday, which generally, you know, knackers up 3 or 4 weeks fishing. And there's probably, while I was away, there's probably more fish out of the folly than there has been, certainly has been since, and probably was in the 6 weeks previous.
Yeah, in October, August.
Did I say August? Yeah, 4th of October.
Yeah, I know you always miss the autumn period, don't you, normally? You normally like working overtime to save up for the oldie, and then you've got to workloads to catch up when you get back because you're skin, and then you missed a few weeks holiday, and you always end up missing the decent period, don't you?
And as well in May, wedding anniversary is the 7th of May, so that knackers spring up as well. So I tell you what, if you and Rachel ever decide to get hitched, have a January wedding.
Yeah, December.
Yeah,
very good idea. That's so we want to get married somewhere hot as well if we ever get married, so
Perfect.
Yeah.
December, January, somewhere hot. Then your anniversary, you can celebrate by having a hot holiday in the winter every year, and your fishing in the spring and autumn is still intact. I'm screwed up for life.
Yeah, that's extremely well thought out. I hadn't actually planned, but now it all makes sense.
Yeah.
Cool. Right. Who have we not had? Ting Tong, Ian McMillan. Let's get him in.
Session where it all went wrong, the disaster. One that still sticks very much in my mind as one of my first ever trip to Christchurch, which was probably going back to about 2002. It wasn't as big as it is now. It was only a smaller lake because it was the little pit was next door, and I managed to get in a peg called Peg Two, and I sort of knew a bit about the lake, and it was very much ruled by, back then we were all using Series 5s, you know, the Fox, they're very much frowned upon now. But and it's amazing, even thinking about the story, trying to relate to you now, that I'm thinking about all the things back then. If I knew back then what I know now, you would just do things completely different and probably have absolutely annihilated the place. But it was quite warm and there was a lot of fish feeding on the surface and blah, blah, blah. So me being rubbish, and I was convinced that I'd had petals feeding down in Peg 2. In fact, I know I have because I could see its shoulders when it was, you know, it was feeding. But I think that first session, I think I lost 6 or 7 carp. And I think I landed one, which even in anybody's ratio is absolutely shocking. I was having zigs snapping. You know, don't forget, I was coming across a different level of angler. There was anglers that were streets ahead of me. And in mind, I'd served my apprentice on places like Horseshoe and Linear. But even though it's very close to those lakes, Christchurch, it was always different gravy. It always seemed to attract a different standard of angler. And I'd gone in there quite green, and I got absolutely royally kicked in the balls for it, you know. To lose that many fish. I mean, back then, they weren't as big. Petals was obviously miles bigger than anything else. It, you know, that back then was 45 pounds, and that's 14, 15 years ago. But you were fishing for a lot of upper 20s to mid 30s things, you know, fish like the ironing board and the big fully and the orange fish and the black mirror. And I think I lost a few on zigs by basically the uplink just snapping. You know, poorly tied. I don't know what line I was using at the time and what size hooks and blah, blah, blah. You know, it was a long time ago, but the line would just snap. And I remember having a few bites off the bottom and they'd absolutely be flying off and you'd lift into them and they'd be on and just off, ping. Now, the fish in Christchurch, you've got notoriously small mouths and they're very, very used to dealing with rigs. But you look back and you think, well, why? I was only using short hook links and PVA sticks. I was massive. I never used to cast out that PVA stick. Because I was copying everybody else. Because obviously everybody else was using very, very short hook links. And I thought, well, you know, these boys are the bollocks. I've got to be following what these are doing. Now, I've come off Linear and I've come off Horseshoe and I wasn't using short hook links there. I wasn't using solid bags. But I got pulled into that circle of, you know, I wanted to be sociable. I wanted to learn. I wanted to be seen where other people were fishing. And I think I got pulled in too much that I lost me as an angler. I lost the person that I was because I was trying to be like everybody else. And basically, if you look back at it, you were getting these piss-ball intakes. You were lifting into him. And you were, because the hook link was too short, the rig wasn't getting far enough back in the mouth. That was basically what was happening. And you were just pricking them as they weren't doing enough to get rid of the rig. And you look back and you think, well, even if I were using a rig that was double the length at 4 or 5 inches, I think I would have probably landed a lot more. You know, looking back, using a rig 8 to 10 inches, somewhere completely different, you would have landed every carp. I'm fully convinced of that, you know, because everybody at the time was using a shaved down tagonaut or a couple bits of plastic corn and 6 pieces of hemp. And because everybody was doing the same, it was crying out for something different. And I remember once I'd got my head around it and started to do more of what the way I used to fish, because he used to say, oh, you'll never catch it on a boilie in here. You know, the mouths aren't big enough to get a boilie in. You're like, oh, you're, oh, bollocks, that's absolute rubbish. I remember the first time, I think I was using mainline NRG at the time, and there was a local guy to me made me some sort of waftery type hook baits. And I put one out, and I had the hamster at £32 on it within about an hour. And then, I'm not saying we started the craze of people putting boilies in, but they seemed to love it, and we started putting more and more larger food items into the mix. And we started catching loads, longer rigs, got rid of the Series 5s and all the short hook link rubbish, and we went back to boilie fishing. And then, mysteriously, years after that, the fish started to grow. Now, was that because, I know they dug the new lake into the big lake, so obviously these fish had managed to harvest a load of new natural food, but I just lost my way a bit, really. And that first trip was, I took it very badly. And even thinking about it now, I fished absolutely, I was totally out of my depth to go on there and think that. But probably looking back, if I'd gone on there and did what I did normally, I probably would have landed them. The fact that I for quite a long time after, for quite a few months, I didn't realise what I was doing because I was getting suckered into fishing the same way as everybody else. When really, you know, you should just try and take snippets of what other people do and adapt that into the sort of angle you are and not be somebody else, you know. So that was a total disaster. I don't even want to talk about it anymore. So that was where it all went bloody wrong for me.
Well, we've had a couple with, or I've mentioned one or two with Raysbury. But, yes, I don't know. I just think I've had so many disasters in my fishing. It's a good job I've had a couple of highlights along the way that would cover things up. But the story I told about Mary, those two stories are just awful and probably scarred me for life. And do you know what? I'm going to be really honest with you. I haven't had anything as bad as that since those days. I get it wrong as much as anybody else, and I really do. And I everybody thinks because I do what I do, because lots of guys do what they do within this industry, that they're absolutely perfect. You know, you see the odd one on the telly and they never show you the disasters, but we all get them. I think probably another one, we'll go back to the 4 ounce lead in the nether regions thing. I went to the car park late when I wasn't in the right frame of mind, and I did put a lead from, I forgot what the swim's called, it's just to the right of Trumpton's, out on the end of the Works Banks bar, because I'd seen two fish, one of which was Heather and the other one was Chunky, just grubbing around, going up and down the bar, and I put a lead there. This is before I could hardly walk for about a week, and I hooked one of those fish. I'll never know which one it was, and we battled for a while, and a couple of guys had blown up a boat for me to go out and get after it, but it had come off. And after that, I went up as a social, got a lead in the nether regions, and I never went back again. I didn't go back for 10 years because that one incident made it, I found it hard to live with. You know, and I genuinely, you know, me hooking a carp, you know, from what was sort of generally considered at the time the hardest lake in the known universe, and for it to fall off really, really broke my heart. But, I didn't have the time being in the army, and, it was just the right thing to do to go elsewhere and just keep catching a few smaller fish, really, and learning the tricks of the trade. But I've lost some good fish all over the place. But yeah, losing Mary and maybe Heather the Leather were probably the two worst occasions I've ever had.
Oh, I bet it did. I've got the tissues. That is, I think it's better if you don't see them.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I never fished for Basil. I photographed her a couple of times for people. I was on the car park lake at the time, and this is after I got out of the army. But I never ever fished for Basil, but incredible fish. And people say, we probably give them a bit too much space, and we probably do. But those are the animals that have shaped the industry that is so massive today, and people should never forget that.
Thank you to Ian McMillan and to Chilli. We sneak Chilli in there. I mean, as we said before, losing Mary must be a bit of a sickener. Heather the Leather again, truly iconic fish. Sorry?
I say that is... I've been listening to him while I was recording him, and you feel the pain. They're just two of the iconic history fish of that era.
Yeah, we had a few people in the last series about losing... the Black Mirror, I mean, that must be a tough one to get over as well if you're really serious about carp, you know, and you're fishing, you know, one of the most serious lakes there is, one of the most desirable fish, and then to lose it and to know you've lost it, wow. And Mary was, you know, probably the most iconic fish. It's a bit of a killer, but you know, obviously things are in perspective. It's only fishing, you know. Would you ever let it ruin your life? No. Got a bit of an epic one to finish off with, haven't we, for this one? Oh, there was a story I don't know if we mentioned this before, but it was a kind of a you hinted at it before, a disaster session that was actually Roger Bacon. It was a bit of a disaster session for me, actually. We'd just got our Elstow 1 tickets. Well, Roger had had a ticket for a few years, and I just got it. I'd been waiting a couple of years. Ended up getting a ticket. The ticket ran from January to January. It was an the 1st of January, New Year's Day. It was extremely mild. We had some, it'd been cold, but we had some really strong southerly winds and 14 degrees day and night, wind and rain. But just that, when you've had a cold snap in the winter, just what you want. Ties in with Elstow being very deep and fishes pretty well in the winter anyway. It timed in with our ticket starting. I think it was actually the 2nd of January we drove down there. I'd just bought a new car. It was an Audi A4 Estate in green. I'd bought it from the auctions, paid quite a bit of money for it. 2 years old, year and a half, 2 years old, something like that. And the injector went on the way down there. One of the injectors went, so it was running like a dog. It was really sort of chuffing along the motorway. We'd stop. Roger was following me in his red Cavalier that he had at the time, Vauxhall Cavalier. We'd stopped in the early hours for some breakfast at a service station, 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, maybe a bit later, because I remember as we left the service station, it was just getting light and it was winter, so it was maybe five, six in the morning. And we'd got 5 minutes outside the service station. I was in the middle lane, Roger was in the outside lane, lane 3. And I just saw it all happen in slow motion. The traffic stopped up in front of Roger. I glanced at Roger and seen that he hadn't seen it stopping. And I thought, there's no way, even if he slams on now, there's no way he's not going to hit the car in front. Anyway, I just watched it all happen. It was in slow motion. exactly that. He didn't stop in time. He slammed up the back of the car in front in the fast lane. I've stopped. The whole motorway stopped. I've gone over to have a look, and it's the front end of his car just smashed in. It's water all over the floor, the radiator's gone. And we've been excited about this session. I've been waiting years for this ticket for a lake that was full of 40s and 30s, very big fish for the time, and it had lots of them. And I was just wow, how, as you said, if it had happened on the way home, it wouldn't have been quite as bad as on the way there. But it was just all a bit surreal. We ended up pushing his vehicle onto the hard shoulder. Bear in mind, my vehicle's not working properly either. And we decided, I don't think we were that far. We were maybe half an hour to go in the journey of what is a 3-hour journey for me. So we decided to try and tow him the rest of the way at rush hour. Obviously now it's a Monday morning or something, and by the time this has all happened, swapped insurance details and everything, it's 7-8 o'clock in the morning, which is rush hour. And so I towed his car up the hard shoulder. We can't have been that far. Maybe we were 20 minutes, half an hour away from the lake, but that was the option. We thought we'd try and get his car to the lake and then ring the RAC and sort it out while we were fishing, so we didn't miss the fishing session. But obviously my car is running like a dog anyway, and then trying to tow another car full of fishing gear, we absolutely limped up the hard shoulder 15 mile an hour. Ended up getting him to the lake, and I think there are pictures knocking about actually of his car on the back of the RAC truck. We didn't ring the RAC truck until he needed to go home. I think he might have used my RAC as well. I think I had any car cover, any car I was in. So once we got to the lake, we just said we were in his car, and managed to get him towed home. Yeah, and my car ended up costing me $1,000 for a bloody injector. A car that I'd had about 2 weeks. There was an Audi garage right near Elstow 1, just on the roundabout, like an Audi main dealer. So I took it in there. It was an intermittent fault. They took it up and down the bloody A10 or whatever the A6, I think it is. Took it up and down there. It was fine. They give it me back. Charged me £200 to look at it, giving me back, and the second I got in it, it started doing it again. I took it back into the while we're fishing, took it back into the Audi garage and said, it's still got a fault. They were like, well, we can't find it. Then literally 5 minutes on the way home, it started doing it again, ended up limping all the way, 3-hour drive, limping all the way back to Blackpool. Yeah, that can go in the books as a disaster session, I think. Yeah, car problems again, which are bane of my life. But let's finish off with Briggsy, unless you've remembered any more.
Yeah, was that around the time where there was quite a bit of mild weather and Pitwan was doing some fish?
I did actually catch, I think it had been think it had been slow for the previous couple of weeks, but yeah, I had what did I have? I had two, I think, a 30 and a 26, like a mid 30 and a 26 out of the dugout. And Roger was to the left in the pump. Now, I don't know if he caught that session, but he definitely had fish. He might have caught, but we ended up coming back the following week and Roger had a decent hit, including the King of Elstow, is it? They called it. Really pretty
big scaly thing, about 38 pound.
Yeah, Roger had like five fish in like sick windy conditions, and then we came back the week after, he had another couple, but all the bites were about the same time, like an hour before it got dark, so maybe like 4 in the afternoon. He had a window of an hour because he had all his bites at the same time, and he had a little window, and what we noticed on the lake shows how narrow the bite times can be, because he was getting the bites exactly the same time every day. And if a lot of people would redoing their rods for the night at that time, so there's a lot of people around the lake didn't even have any rods in, you know, they were spotting, markering, whatever. It just goes to show, like, sometimes you can do everything right and just miss the feeding period because you don't know when it is. So obviously when we went back the week after, you know, Roger had all his rods ready, he was redoing his rods at midday, making sure everything was settled for early afternoon. He had all his rigs tied, so if he did get a bite, he could get the rod straight back out again, because it was such a narrow window. And it happened for 2 weeks, and I remember, like, the second week, once we completely sussed it out, it was literally, I remember looking around the lake, there might have been 10 people on, and they're like, nobody had rods out at the time when you wanted them out. Seen people reeling in to get ready again for the evening, and it was just like, wow, everybody's completely missing out on what might be a tiny window. This goes to show,
wasn't it?
Say again.
It was like clockwork with everyone redoing and respotting the spots at the same time there.
Yeah, I mean, I was trying to like to. I always try to find when the bite times are. Like, you know, one of the questions I'll always ask anybody is, oh, yeah, did anyone caught? Yeah, so-and-so had a couple of fish yesterday or day before, whatever. The first thing I ask them is when, what time? Because most likely that's the feeding time. And if you can find out that little bit of information and adjust your rechucking or whatever around that time. And it happened a few weeks ago, and Roger and I were down on Nash's Lake. Roger ended up having three fish out of the cops all at a random time, like middle of the afternoon, between 1 p.m. and 3 p.m. And they only found that out because we were actually fishing on the church, and he put two rods in the cops. And on the Sunday, where we weren't actually going to move on to the church until the Monday, but he was fishing like right on the bank between the cops and the church, so he could get a couple of rods out. So he flicked a couple out, had a bite randomly at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So obviously the following day, when we moved on to the cops properly, we knew to make sure we had the rods in at that time. Anyway, Roger had a bite. Same thing again, 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Then the following day, he had one slightly earlier, 1 o'clock in the afternoon, but all were between like 1 and half, 2, 3 days running, where you could have easily missed that period. It didn't look like an obvious feeding time. Yeah, you saw it. Yeah, always pay attention to feeding times. Right, let's finish off with Steve Briggs.
Oh, God, yeah, there's one that really stands out, and it was down at Cassian, and as soon as anyone asked me about a disaster, this one just pinged it's straight there, because it was terrible, really. It was 2010, and we got down there for the usual winter session, December, and everything was okay, you know. I mean, it was snowing when we got there, which is a little bit unusual, but no problem. But anyway, a few days in, nothing had happened. No signs of fish, no bleeps, nothing. And I'd got some bait rolled air-dried. You know, normally I just took freezer bait, and we had friends down there where we could keep the bait in their freezer. Well, they were away or something happened, so I couldn't store any bait with them. So I'd got this bait air-dried and rolled for the trip, and when I got it, I smelled it, and I thought, that doesn't smell right at all. It didn't smell horrible, but it didn't smell right. It didn't smell anything like the bait did normally, but I thought, well, I'll use it anyway, you know, because I'm sure it's going to be all right. Well, anyway, you know, a few days went past, and a week went past, and the thing was, you know, I started moving swims, trying to get on the fish, thinking I wasn't on the fish. But other people around me were catching fish. You know, I mean, the people weren't that close. They might have been a couple of hundred yards away. But everywhere I went, everyone else I could see were catching fish, you know, just like the odd one here and there. And I wasn't. So, you know, things started sort of nagging away. Anyway, a few more days went past. Another week went past. So I was like 2 weeks without a bite. And it was really starting to niggle me. You know, there's got to be something wrong with this bait, surely. Anyway, we were fishing in a little area where I knew a guy had caught a few fish a couple of weeks back. And it was a horrible swim. It was in a little shady area that never got the sun all day. And in December, you know, it was like the frost was on the ground all day. It was really cold, really horrible. And I was with Joan and she hated it in there. So she said, you know, can we just move somewhere with a bit of sunshine? And I said, yeah, it's horrible here. So I started loading up the boat. And I had an inflatable boat for us to sit in and a solid like fiberglass boat to put all the gear in. So as I was putting the gear in, I heard this crack. And I thought, oh, it's, you know, there was ice in the bottom of the boat, so I just thought it was a bit of ice breaking. Well, anyway, all of our gear, you can imagine, we're there for 3 or 4 weeks in the winter, so we've got a lot of gear. We're moving up the lake. I stopped off to photograph a fish with my mate, so probably took us the best part of an hour to really reach the swim we were heading for. Pulled up in the swim, started to get the gear out of the boat, picked the first bag up, and the boat was full up with water, and literally all of our gear was in there, all of our clothes, the beds, you know, everything, like DVD player, DVDs, all of them were like underwater in the boat. The boat had, like, this crack that I'd heard was actually the boat splitting. It wasn't the ice at all. So the boat had filled up with water. And luckily, you know, we had our passports and everything, money with us in the front boat, but it was, you know, a disaster. So we're getting all the gear out, hanging all the stuff in the trees around us, and this little boat pulled up. And they turned out to be, I thought they were guards of pesh coming to check the tickets, but they were firemen. And they said, oh, we're doing some night training tonight, you know, just so that you know, because there's going to be boats out on the lake. You're probably better off not fishing, but that's what we're going to be doing tonight. And I thought, well, there's no chance of me not fishing. You know, I'm going to get the rods out. You know, what's the problem sort of thing? So anyway, you know, laying in bed that night, and I could hear these boats coming. I thought, they're getting ever so close. And, you know, and they were getting closer and closer. And before I had a chance to do anything, I heard the sounder box going off. Jumped out and looked out, and there was three speedboats. They were actually three abreast, but going about 3 foot from the edge of the bank. They were doing these like night training manoeuvres, but literally just straight through me lines. And oh Jesus! So I had to pull for a break. It's around his prop and all that, and he didn't even know. So I pulled for a break, thinking that was it. Well, anyway, this went on all night, and by the morning, all of me rods were just literally laying on the floor. They'd all been wiped out. Some of the spools were empty. This was, by now, it was 2.5-3 weeks into the trip. So my gear was wrecked on the floor. All of our gear was hanging up in the trees, doing our best to dry it out. It was just frozen, do you know what I mean? Yeah. Clothes and everything. And I still hadn't had a bite in 3 weeks. And honestly, it's the lowest I've ever been in my fishing. You know, if ever there was a time where I thought I could just left the whole lot there and gone home, that was it. And yeah, I suppose they're the times you find out what you're made of, I suppose. And I thought, right, now re-spool everything. I'm going to get everything dried out. We're going to carry on. We still had a week left of the trip. And my mate come over and he said, well, look, you know, I've still got a 5 kilo bag of my boilies left. Do you want them just to try them, see if it is the bait? And I said, yes, you know, by then I was sure the bait was duff. I was sure it was. So I re-spooled all my lines, settled the rigs up again, got his 5 kilo bag of baits, put a couple out there, and that night had a 48 mirror, really heavily scaled, almost fully scaled mirror, and it was like I'd won the lottery. Do you know what I mean? The relief of catching that fish, well, it just put everything right. You know, 3 weeks without a bleep, the worst day of my life, all their clothes ruined, all my rods been wiped out, and I caught that fish. And I actually went on, in the final week, I actually caught 7 fish. So, it was definitely the bait. So I turned it around, but it was the worst session of my life. It was horrible.
Yeah. Well, that sounds it. So that sounds... Yeah, we've all had mishaps, but that just sounds like a catalogue of disasters. No, I suppose
it was just getting worse and worse.
Yeah. I suppose with that boat thing, I suppose you look at the boat stayed afloat, because if it cracked, it could have all disappeared.
Well, it was lucky it did stay afloat, actually, because, it could quite easily have just sunk behind us. Probably it would have, if we'd spent a bit more time out on the lake, it might well have sunk, I suppose. It was virtually full up with water, but you couldn't see it. Where all our gear was piled up in it, you couldn't see it. We didn't know until we actually pulled in.
Wow.
But yeah, it was what a sight that was.
Bit of an epic one from Briggsy Mark.
Yeah, like I said, there are a catalogue of disasters.
Yeah, there's been a couple where the disaster's been like a foreign trip. You can imagine if you're miles away from home, it being pretty hectic. In fact, a friend of ours, he's living in Thailand currently, Dave, he was running those pirate carp adventures. Do you remember that? Was it, he bought the big boat. He was doing foreign trips, living out there. But yeah, he had a disaster one where he'd forgot what side of the road he was on when they'd driven all night to get somewhere, and ended up driving his van into the front of another car with a woman driving. She broke her leg, her bones popping through the legs. Obviously, it's his fault. He feels sick as a dog. He'd literally just pulled outside the lake and totaled her van. Broke a woman's leg. It was in bad shape, and I remember reading his post about this particular lake. Like, I never heard the full story at the time. I knew he'd had an accident, but a year later he posted like one of the worst weeks of my life. Basically having no vehicle in France, hire a vehicle, being responsible for an accident where somebody got badly injured, and it sounded like a little bit of a disaster.
That sounds like a major disaster, that.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. These things are sent to try us, aren't they? So, anyway, yes. Don't leave on too much of a downer. You just reminded me, actually, that car crasher, Roger, that he was telling us about. Yeah, one of the details I'd forgotten was, he had these, 5-litre containers of water, 2 of them, that were I think they were on the front seat of the car, and as he smashed into the back of this other car, Dave exploded on the dashboard and drenched him and everything inside the car. As if crashing isn't bad enough. Yeah, I forgot about that bit.
Soaking wet in a freezing cold January on the hard shoulder.
Yeah, the water exploded everywhere. Yeah. These things are sent to try. It's why we do what we do. It's all part of the life experience, isn't it?
And to coin our old phrase, the carp gods giveth and the carp gods taketh away.
They certainly do. On that note, we'll leave it. Until next time, tight lines.
The Carpcast Extra. Turn on.